Yes. So I'm going to be talking about this model that has been proposed by me and Roberto Pereira and Carlo Rovelli. At the end of the last few slides, I will talk about the relation to this model put forward by Laurent and Kirol, and it was also mentioned by Levine and Speziale in their most recent paper. So let's go to the outline, the next slide. So we'll begin with an introduction and motivation for what we're doing, and then we'll review the classical theory, the continuum theory, and then discretize it, and then talk about the quantum theory and how we're going to impose the simplicity constraints, and then give the vertex amplitude, and then discuss briefly the relation to other models, and then conclude. And I should also say you should feel free to interrupt me and ask questions. I actually practiced the talk this morning, and it was shorter than I thought it would be. So feel free to ask questions. Next slide. So the basic motivation is we're trying to correct the Barrett-Crane model. There were these calculations done of the graviton propagator, and there were difficulties with the non-diagonal components of the graviton propagator, and this seemed to be due to the fact that the Barrett-Crane vertex does not depend on intertwiners. Another way of viewing this is the following. In the Barrett-Crane model, the intertwiner degrees of freedom are completely frozen out because you impose the simplicity constraints in the quantum theory strongly. That is, you require the corresponding operators to annihilate the wave functions, and I'll talk about this later.
I'm sorry, what is an intertwiner degree of freedom?
Oh, so in the spin foam formalism, you're summing over spin foams, and the spin foams are labeled by spins on the faces and intertwiners on edges. You constrain what spin foams you include in the sum. And in the Barrett-Crane model, these intertwiners are completely constrained. So, in fact, you're not really summing over any intertwiners in the Barrett-Crane model. The intertwiners are completely determined by the spins. I mean, they're intertwiners in the same sense that's used in loop quantum gravity, intertwiners between representations.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm. So this seems to be a problem that we don't have intertwiner degrees of freedom in the Barrett-Crane model, but then we realize that we've been making a mistake because the simplicity constraints are, in fact, second class. That is, they do not Poisson commute, weakly Poisson commute. And so they shouldn't be imposed strongly anyway. And furthermore, beyond simply having intertwiner degrees of freedom, it would be very nice if in fact, the intertwiner degrees of freedom matched exactly those of loop quantum gravity. And this would give us a nice matching between the covariant and Hamiltonian approaches and might be a good indication that we're on the right path. And so the philosophy is the following. Basically, we view problem two as the basic problem. There are many proposals for imposing second-class constraints in quantum theory, but they always suffer from ambiguity. So so we're also using the desire for isomorphism with loop quantum gravity. We're using this desire to guide us in how we impose the simplicity constraints. And hopefully, with the new model, this will solve the problems with the graviton propagator. Next slide, slide four. We start with the classical theory. I'm going to include this Holst term in the action from the very start. This is one way of incorporating the Barbara-Mertzi parameter into the spin foam formalism. You basically have two choices. Either you can incorporate gamma into the action or you can incorporate it into the simplicity constraints. I've here incorporated it into the action, so I'm calling this the Holst BF action. And the simplicity constraints are the same as usual. It's given by the equation there, and basically the simplicity constraint ensures that the Bs are Lie algebra valued two forms. It ensures that they're of one of these two forms shown on the slide, either E wedge G or star E wedge G. And if we substitute these two solutions to the simplicity constraint back into the action, we get the Holst action. These two different sectors actually correspond to two different gamma sectors, two different values of the Barbara-Mertzi parameter. And actually, if you're more careful and you include the Newton constant, you've seen these two sectors, the Newton constant is actually also different. This is actually something I don't hear people talk about very much. So it seems that, as far as I can see, that there's no topological sector when you have a non-trivial gamma. We just have two different possible Barbara-Mertzi sectors. Next slide.
Sorry, can I?
Is there a question?
Hello, yeah. Kazeng, can you go to back to the previous slide?
Sure.
This is Laurent. So I agree that you can have these two MIRSI parameters, but you have to do some non-trivial rescaling of the area form. And for instance, the limit gamma goes to zero has a very different meaning in both sectors. Right. In one sector, you get usual gravity. In the other sector, you get a topological theory. So the interpretation, because you rescale G Newton, you have to be careful of the interpretations of the spins in the spin form models, which are quite different.
Okay. Yes. Yes, if you said, well, yes, that's true. It's you can't really take the gamma limits. If you were to formally take the gamma limit, you'd only have contribution from the second term in the action, and you would, in fact, have a topological theory. That's true. Going back to slide 5, talking about the discretization. So we introduce a triangulation of the space-time by four simplices, and we'll be talking about the four simplices and then the tetrahedra, which are on the boundary of the four simplices, and then the triangles, which are on the boundary of the tetrahedra. And there's also a dual picture where the four simplices are dual to vertices, and the tetrahedra are dual to edges, and the triangles are dual to faces. And so we'll use the symbols there in the third column. Usually one uses E for the tetrahedra, but we're going to use T because we want to avoid confusion with the symbol for the tetrad. So the basic idea in a Regé discretization is that we want the geometry to be flat on each four simplex. Well, that's one way to view it. In a Regé discretization, you're actually specifying the geometry by the length of edges on the four simplex, but this is equivalent to specifying a flat geometry up to diffeomorphism inside each four simplex. So we'll think about it this way. Geometry is flat on each four simplex. And then curvature is concentrated around the triangles. You have a link around each triangle, and you have non-trivial holonomies, and this is where the curvature is encoded. The diagram on the slide is a two-dimensional version of this. The link around a point is made up of triangles and edges, and if you go to four dimensions, the link around a triangle is made up of four simplices and tetrahedra. Next slide. The basic discrete variables are motivated as follows. Actually, much of this is not very important. It's just a motivation for the discrete variables. One can take the discrete variables as given in the end, but this is how we motivate it. So first, introduce a geometry on the space-time that is flat in each four simplex, and fix a reference point within each four simplex and also within each tetrahedron. We fix a reference point basically because we need a tangent space to work with in order to define some variables. And then define these V parallel transport operators that parallel transport from a point in from the reference point in the tetrahedra to a neighboring four simplex. Parallel transport defined by this metric G, and this is well defined because the metric G is locally flat. And then we specify a tetrad at each of these reference points such that they reproduce the metric at those points. And then we define this matrix V with the capital indices, with these internal indices. These parallel transport these tetrads. And this becomes one of our basic discrete variables. And because the parallel transport preserves the metric, this matrix is a member of SO4. This is basically the holonomy degree of freedom that's being discretized. And then within each tetrahedron, because of the local flatness of the metric, we can take the tetrad and we can parallel transport it over the entire tetrahedron and then we can perform this integral shown in the equation at the bottom of the slide, and then we can define these b variables. And this is the second set of discrete variables being used in the theory. And you can see that that this b is skew in the indices I and j, so it's taking values in the SO4 Lie algebra. You can think of it that way. Next slide. And it will also be convenient for us to find this U quantity. So if you're given a triangle F and two tetrahedra and its link, this UF is basically the product of the Vs in the clockwise direction from T prime to T. I can talk about clockwise because I'm assuming that these various n simplices are oriented, so you can define a sense of clockwise. So now let's mention the constraints on these variables. First is the constraint that the Bs should be parallel transported by these Us. A consequence of this is that within each link around an F, only one B is independent. And in fact, when we go to the when we write down the discrete action, only one of these Bs will appear in the action. So in a sense, this first constraint is being incorporated by definition of the variables. The second constraint on these variables is the closure constraint, that if you sum over the Bs in a single tetrahedron, they give zero. And this generates gauge transformations. And when we go to quantum theory, it imposes gauge invariance. And so it's really the analog of the Gauss constraint. And then finally, we have the simplicity constraints, the discretized simplicity constraints. And these can be broken up into three categories. Category one, we refer to as the diagonal simplicity constraints. And this is a constraint on the B at a single triangle. And it basically ensures that B is simple. It's of the form E wedge E or star E wedge E. And then the second set of simplicity constraints we call the off-diagonal simplicity constraints. And this is a constraint on the Bs within a single tetrahedron. You can think of it as requiring that the Bs the first simplicity constraint ensures that each B is of the form E wedge E, or the dual is of the form E wedge E. And the second simplicity constraint basically ensures that within a given tetrahedron, these vectors all lie in a common three-dimensional plane, and so they can actually define a tetrahedron. But, well, this is touching upon a reformulation of the simplicity constraints, which I will mention later. And the last simplicity constraint we sometimes call the dynamical simplicity constraint. And in fact, with our formulation, when the rest of the constraints are solved, you can show that this third simplicity constraint is automatically solved. So we don't need to worry about it, which is rather nice.
Okay, so what are the variables at this stage that you want to focus on? It is supposed to be that with each triangle, you have a, or with each face, you have got a B. Is that right?
That's right.
Okay, independent of the T label, because of the first constraint is takes care of that.
Yes, that's right.
Okay. And then what about the U label? It's associated with a face and two tetrahedra, which are intersecting at that face?
That's right.
Okay.
Next slide. Yeah, so let us write down the discrete variable. I mean the discrete action. So actually, I should say something more about your question, Abhay. We're thinking of the Vs as the basic variables, and this U is defined in terms of the Vs.
All right.
Just so we have some independent holonomies.
Okay. So when you do the variation, you do variation with respect to V and not U. Is that right?
That's right.
Okay.
Yes. Okay, so the discrete action, we use a discrete action shown on slide 8. It has both a bulk term and a boundary term. And from the boundary term, we can read off what the boundary variables are. The Bs on the boundary are are some of these variables. They're elements of the SO4 Li algebra. And the other variables on the boundary are these U's. So once we get to the theory on the boundary, yes, that now the U's become fundamental variables.
Okay, can you explain why in the continuum there was no boundary term, but in the discrete theory a boundary term suddenly arose?
In the continuum theory, I mean, whether you have a boundary term or not, it depends on what you're fixing on the boundary, whether you're fixing B's or U's on the boundary. That's the case.
Okay, so what are you fixing?
We're fixing B's on the boundary.
B's on the boundary?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. Also from this boundary term, we can read off a symplectic structure. And I'm specifying the symplectic structure just by noting that this particular combination of B's on the right-hand side of the second equation, this acts as right invariant vector fields on the corresponding U group elements. And so from that statement, you can write down the Poisson brackets if you wish. And so then we note that in the limits of small gamma or large gamma, we have this following relation between the B's and the right invariant vector fields. For small gamma, the B basically acts as the dual of the right invariant vector fields, and for large gamma, the B acts as the right invariant vector fields. Next slide.
There was something about symplectic structure. Can you say what it is on?
What was the question?
Yes. On slide 8, you
yes.
write down symplectic structure, and
yes.
then you say JS is equal to. So what is the symplectic structure? It's a two-form on what space, and why is it a two-form? And
yes, okay. So the symplectic structure, it's, first of all, the phase space consists of these variables B and U. And
that's B and V, you just told us.
Yes, that's for the space-time theory. But now, when we're talking about symplectic structure, we're talking about a symplectic structure on a phase space of boundary data.
Okay.
And yes, and so for the boundary data, the basic boundary data are the B's and these U's.
Okay, so I'm still confused. So the action when you do the variation.
Yes.
Do you do variation with respect to U or Z, both in the bulk and the boundary?
We do a variation with respect to V.
Right. So why is then the boundary data U and not V?
Well, because you look at the boundary term, you see what's multiplying B, and you say these U's are the variables conjugate to B. This is the motivation.
Okay. Go ahead.
Okay.
Then J is what?
G? Where?
J.
J. So the symplectic structure is such that the J's the Hamiltonian vector field determined by these J's are the right invariant vector fields on the group elements. That's the statement. So I'm not explicitly writing the symplectic structure, but it's implicit from the equation.
I see. Okay, thank you.
Sure. Next slide. So to talk about the quantum theory, I will need to review some basics about the self-dual structure of the SO4 group and its representation theory. SO4 can be decomposed as a product of two copies of SU2, and you also have to divide by this this action of Z2 in order to get SO4, and then the Lie algebra of SO4 decomposes into self-dual and anti-self-dual parts. If we're given a basis of the SO4 Lie algebra, we would denote this basis by these J generators with the capital indices. Given such generators in SO4, we can construct a basis of the self-dual and anti-self-dual parts of the algebra using the first equation and the second line. And this is depending on a particular choice of basis in R4. So the statement is this basis of the self-dual and anti-self-dual parts of the algebra is not canonical. It really depends on the choice of basis in R4. And it really only depends on the choice of this n vector. The choice of the v's just rotates the algebra within itself. So basically, the ambiguity in the choice of this basis is it's basically a choice of reference frame, it's a choice of n. You can think of it that way. And we've defined these generators of the self-dual and anti-self-dual parts such that they satisfy the usual angular momentum commutation relations. And then we also have the Casimir operators for the SO4 theory given there. The spectra of the Casimir operators are given in terms of two half integers, j plus and j minus. And not surprisingly, given that information, one should not be too surprised that the SO4 representations decompose into SU2 representations. The SO4 representations are labeled by two half integers. And the D here, these are representation matrices, and the SO4 representation matrices are just products of SU2 representation matrices. Okay. Well, maybe I should stop and ask if there's questions. I forgot about stopping to ask for questions. Is everything clear so far?
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay. So next slide, slide 10. Now we're going to come to the quantum theory. When talking about the quantum theory, it will be convenient to switch to the dual picture. So we're going to be talking about the two complex. So we're going to be talking about the vertices, faces, and edges of the two complex, dual to the triangulation. And with each three surface, we will associate a Hilbert space. So first look at the intersection of this three surface with the two complex, and this gives you a graph. And then we just take the Hilbert space associated with this graph. So you have a copy of SO4 for each edge of the graph, and then we take the product of those copies of SO4, and we look at the L2 space on these products. And this is our Hilbert space associated with sigma. Yes, and so then the basic operators acting on this Hilbert space, well, obviously the holonomy operators will just act by multiplication, and the B operators will act by this combination of, it's given by the bottom equation on the slide, where the J's are the right invariant vector fields on the group elements. So it gives you the explicit action of the B's. So that gives you the Hilbert space and the action of the basic operators. Is there a question?
No, at least for us, the symbols are completely scrambled. I don't know if anybody else has this problem, but on the...
Yeah, this program too. Yeah.
So it's a little hard to... When you say delta, we see a psi. When you say minus, we see a greater than sign and such things. So it's a little bit difficult to follow. So maybe it's a good idea to say in words what you are saying rather than pointing out the equations, because the equations, many of them are just completely scrambled.
Okay. All right. So should I repeat this?
So do you understand the Hilbert space is just a space of quadratical functions on SO4 to the power of to E copies of SO4. Is that right?
That's right.
Okay. The usual thing. And then
usual
the momentum are represented by these vector fields, which have to do with the operator J.
Yes, that's right.
Okay. Let's just do it qualitatively, because it's difficult to follow it in terms of equations, because equations are scrambled.
Okay. Okay, next slide. Slide 11. So to you solve the Gauss constraint as you usually do by looking at the SO4 gauge invariant subspace of this Hilbert space. And this this is the solution to the closure constraint. And a basis of this space is given by the SO4 spin networks. They're either given explicitly by the equation there. The SO4 spin networks are just products of each SO4 spin network is just a product of two SU2 spin networks that everybody is familiar with. So then we talk about histories of quantum states, these spin foams. We think of a spin foam as a history of a spin network. So if you think about a spin network evolving in time, it generates a two-complex in space-time. And the spins on the edges of the graph become spins on faces, and the intertwiners on the nodes of the graph become intertwiners on edges of the two-complex. Usual thing. Next slide. So now we come to the diagonal simplicity constraints. Writing out the constraint operator, it's just the difference between the self-dual Casimir and the anti-self-dual Casimir operator. So, in the particular case, when gamma is very small or very large, I should have said that more carefully. In general, the diagonal quantum simplicity constraint is given by the top equation, and in the case of gamma very small or gamma very large, then this operator takes the form of the difference between the two Casimirs. And so then the solution is very simple. It just imposes that J plus is equal to J minus on each F. That is, the representations have to be simple on the faces. It's more complicated for intermediate gamma. So the main reason for assuming either gamma very small or gamma very large. So now we have an interesting question. We always have in the back of our head, how is this spin foam going to be related to loop quantum gravity? And so the spins on these faces, we expect them to be somehow related to the spins in loop quantum gravity spin networks. So let JSO4 be equal to J plus equal to J minus here. And then the question is, how is JSO4 related to the J that you see in loop quantum gravity spin networks? We have some ideas of how you can argue that the J loop quantum gravity is equal to twice the JSO4. We have a little bit of confusion, especially with Newton's constant and gamma and things like this. I'm not going to present this argument because it's not, we're still confused about it. but this is going to be consistent with the way we solve the off-diagonal simplicity constraint. Because the diagonal simplicity constraints basically are telling us how we constrain the spins, and the off-diagonal simplicity constraints will tell us how we constrain the intertwiners. And there has to be a matching between the spins and the intertwiners, because the intertwiners are intertwiners between representations. So this identification of the J's in loop quantum gravity with the JSO4 is going to be consistent with how we handle the intertwiners.
But I'm still confused. I mean, this is supposed to be true only if gamma is literally either zero or infinity, right? Because J plus is not equal to J minus unless that happens, is what you said.
Yes, that's true.
So what do you mean that we can get some qualitative agreement or something with loop quantum gravity where gamma is neither zero nor infinity? Is there any?
I'm taking the attitude that gamma is very small or gamma is very large. Maybe this is an invalid attitude, I'm not sure. But
gamma is, I mean, if you believe black hole entropy calculation, something like that, gamma is about quarter, right?
Yes, that's right.
So not completely clear what is being. So if it is quarter, you are saying that it is very small somehow. Therefore,
I'm saying that we're not handling the case that is of direct interest to loop quantum gravity. We would like to handle the case of more general gamma, but we haven't handled the case of more general gamma yet.
Okay, thank you.
So next slide. So for the off-diagonal simplicity constraints, these are constraints on the intertwiners. They're second class, so they should not be imposed strongly, but weakly in some sense. We are being inspired by the Gupta-Bleuler formalism in doing this. So in the Gupta-Bleuler formalism, one is trying to impose the transverse gauge in electromagnetism in quantum theory. So the problem is that when you try to impose a gauge-fixing condition and the corresponding constraint generating the gauge, this is a second-class system. And so the problem that they were solving is similar. In the Gupta-Bleuler formalism, the way that the constraints are satisfied is by matrix elements. The solution space is such that the matrix elements of the constraint are zero. And so we're looking for a space that satisfies this condition. Of course, this is not going to be sufficient to determine the solution space, H physical. So we're going to look for other things to guide us, in particular matching with loop quantum gravity Hilbert space, and maybe some operator equations. Well, you'll see what we do. Next slide. So we begin by reformulating the off-diagonal simplicity constraints. I was hinting at this earlier. So I'm going to summarize in words this reformulation. This slide simply states the reformulation, but it doesn't give you an intuition of why it's true. The intuition is the following, that the diagonal simplicity constraints guarantee you that each b, the bivector is a wedge product between two vectors, and so it determines these two vectors then determine a two-dimensional plane in the internal space. And then the off-diagonal simplicity constraints is the following: if you have a tetrahedron, and you have the four triangles of the tetrahedron, we want the subspaces determined by the triangles to all lie in the same three-dimensional hypersurface. This is essentially the meaning of the off-diagonal simplicity constraint. However, when we reformulate it in this way, something very nice happens. We are able to distinguish between these two sectors of B equals E wedge G or B equals star E wedge G, because we can either require that the two-dimensional planes determined by the Bs lie in the same three-dimensional hypersurface, or we can require that the two-dimensional plane determined by the duals of the Bs lie in a three-dimensional hyperplane. So if a bivector is simple, so is its dual. But now, with this off-diagonal simplicity constraints, we're now distinguishing between these two possibilities. Was that sufficiently clear, I hope?
Good. Yes.
Good. Being more concrete, for the case B is star E wedge E to get this sector, we require that there exists some vector n such that the product of n with b is zero within the same tetrahedron. And the point is that this n has to be the same n for all of the triangles in the tetrahedron. This is the condition that will isolate for us the b equals star e wedge g sector. And then for the other sector, b equals e wedge g, we simply require that there exists some vector n such that the product with the dual of b is zero. And then, in particular, for the case of n shown in the slide, this simplifies a great deal.
Excuse me, there's a question.
Yes.
Yeah, this is Florian. I'm a bit confused by these two. On the one hand, you say that the B equals star E wedge E sector, and then in the formula below, you say that B is equal to E wedge E. Then
yes.
In the lower section, you have B equal E wedge E sector, and then you have in the formula B equals star E wedge E. That's confusing.
Oh, that was a typo. I'm sorry. Yes, you're absolutely right.
Well, thanks, then.
I forget at the moment which is correct. I need to look back. Yes, sorry about that. So which one is which? It's the the equation is correct and the things in green are incorrect. Yeah. You should switch the things, the B equals star Iwo Jee and B equals Iwo Jee in green. It should be switched. Okay, is that good? Right. Next slide. So we're going to reformulate this a little bit further for the quantum theory. So first, let this JI generator be the sum of the self-dual and anti-self-dual generators. This is basically the generator of an SO3 subgroup of SO4. And this is, in fact, the SO3 subgroup which leaves the N vector invariant. For convenience, in this slide, I'm choosing N to be this simple choice of 1, 0, 0, 0. But it should always be kept in mind that this in this reformulation of the simplicity constraint, we only require these equations to hold with respect to one internal vector. It has to be the same internal vector for all of the triangles in the tetrahedron, but a priori, one doesn't fix this internal vector. So we have a table here looking at the different possibilities in the columns. We have this gamma, that is the gamma appearing in this Holst BF action, very small, and this gamma HBF very large, and in the rows we have the B equals star Iwo Jee and B equals Iwo Jee sectors. And so the main thing to notice is that in each of these squares we have a certain limit of the physical gamma in blue, and we have a corresponding equation. So what we see is that there is in fact only two equations that one could possibly be imposing here, considering these two gamma limits, and they in fact correspond to the same physical gamma, which is nice. one can just look at the two boxes on top, and this gives you the two possibilities. And the boxes on the bottom, the two possibilities are just flipped. Next slide, 16. So let H denote this SO3 subgroup generated by these JIs. Under the action of H, the JJ SO4 representation becomes a tensor product representation of the two Js. And then we can decompose this representation using the Clebsch-Gordan series. Introducing some further notation, let H, J, J denote the carrying space for the spin JJ SO4 representation, and then let HJ denote the carrying space for the spin J SU2 representation, and the decomposition just becomes a decomposition of the JJ carrying space. Of course, this decomposition depends on the particular choice of the Js, and so it also depends on the choice of H, which can also be interpreted as a choice of this internal vector N. In this third point, there's a typo. At a node with adjacent spins, I meant to say J1, J1, and J2, J2, et cetera. So those should be pairs of spins. So at a node with those adjacent spins, the SO4 intertwiner space is given by the equation there. We just take a product of the tensor product of the carrying spaces and then take the part that's invariant under the SO4 gauge transformations. So now combining the second equation gives this decomposition into SO3 representations and this equation for the intertwiner space, we see that we can construct two subspaces of the SO4 intertwiner space. First, we can take the product of all of the zero representations of the SO3 subgroup, or we can take the product of all of the spin 2J representations of the SO3 subgroup. I'm calling these I1 and I2. I1 is one-dimensional, and in fact, it's equal to just the BC intertwiner. I also note that on both of these spaces, the off-diagonal simplicity constraints have vanishing matrix elements. So these could be potential solution spaces for the off-diagonal simplicity constraints. Next slide. So now let's look at these spaces a little bit more carefully. Let C4 denote the Casimir for SO4, and C3 denote the Casimir for the SO3 subgroup. And on I, we see that in fact, this constraint, in fact, this C3 annihilates all of the states in I1. So if you go back to slide 15, you see that we've exactly imposed the condition for large gamma. So I1 corresponds to the large gamma case. I2 can be obtained in the following way. First, look at the solutions to this equation 1. Call this I tilde 2. And then I2 is just the SO4 invariant part of this. Now, this equation 1, if you look at the classical limit, it's equation 2 there, that the three-dimensional Casimir should be twice the four-dimensional Casimir. And in fact, this equation corresponds exactly to the equation we want to hold in the small gamma case. But we also take this SO4 invariant part, and one can interpret that as saying that we want equation 2 to hold with respect to some choice of internal vector n. This is our interpretation. So said in that way, this is precisely the simplicity constraint for small gamma. So therefore, we say that I1 solves the simplicity constraint for large gamma, and I1 solves the simplicity constraint for small gamma. I1 is the BC intertwiner leading to the BC model, and so now we ask the question, what is this new space I2, and to what spin flow model does it lead? Next slide, slide 18. Now we construct an embedding of the loop quantum gravity Hilbert space into the SO4 theory Hilbert space. First, we note that the SO3 intertwiner space can be thought of as a subspace of the corresponding carrying space of the representations, of the SO3 representations. And these in turn can be thought of, this tensor product in turn can be thought of as a subspace of the tensor product of the SO4 representation carrying space. Using the decomposition I mentioned a few slides ago. And so now let PSO4 denote the group averaging with respect to the gauge transformations. Let it denote group averaging on this tensor product of carrying spaces. And then we simply define F to be the restriction of this group averaging map to the SO4 intertwiner space. And so then this gives us a map from SO3 intertwiners to SO4 intertwiners. And in fact, the image of this map is precisely the solution to the constraints. The image of this map is precisely I2, which we mentioned on the previous slide. And this map is a little bit abstract for some people, so it's good to also write it in terms of the usual intertwiner basis where you introduce a virtual link, and so that's given by the equation, the large equation on the slide there, and the coefficients, Fi, I plus, I minus, are then given by the evaluation of this spin network on the trivial connection that you see to the right there. So that tells us how we're mapping SO3 intertwiners into SO4 intertwiners. In order to map SO3 spin networks into SO4 spin networks, we also need to say how we're mapping the spins. And we map the spins, we map spin 2J to spin J, J. And combining these together, we have a map from the loop quantum gravity Hilbert space into the SO4. Hilbert space. Next slide, slide 19. Now we can calculate the vertex amplitude. To calculate the vertex amplitude, we calculate the amplitude for a single four simplex. So if we have a single four simplex, we have 10 Bs on the boundary and 10 Us on the boundary. I'm defining some new notation here. So for any two tetrahedra, there's only one triangle in between them. So I define BTT there just to be the BFT, where the F is the unique one determined by the pair of tetrahedra, and then the UTT is defined as shown on the slide. It will also be convenient to introduce a variable representing the momentum conjugate to the U, and that's, I'm calling it pi. Well, we've already introduced the name J, but in essence, we're thinking about this as a classical variable, and it bothers me when I think about j is representing a classical variable. So I renamed it pi. So then the amplitude when we fix the b's on the boundary is given precisely by this first equation. We're integrating over the v's. And then we have the exponential of the action. This is just a standard spin foam calculation. And then we transform to the conjugate variables. We need to do a change of variables from the b's to the pi's. But since the pi's are related to the b's linearly, the Jacobian is just a constant. We can take it out of the integral. And then we get this, we get the final expression there. Now we can just drop this constant because when you rescale the amplitude by a constant, it doesn't have any physical significance. I mean, you can think about it as follows: when you rescale the amplitude, it's equivalent to rescaling the inner product in the Hilbert space. So it doesn't have any physical significance. So now we drop this constant factor and we transform back to the spin network basis. Next slide. And then we get the usual vertex amplitude, which is the 15J symbol. And then combining this this 15J symbol with the embedding F mentioned a couple of slides ago, we get the model. So then I've written there the partition function and then written out the corresponding amplitude. This is a spin foam model for loop quantum gravity, where you really have a history of loop quantum gravity spin networks with faces labeled by SO3 representations and edges labeled by intertwiners, which is what we were seeking. And also in this last box, I've changed notation from T to E just because this is what's usually used in spin foam literature. So are there any questions so far?
I think people here at least are pretty lost, so I think what would be best would be if you just finish it and then we can go back.
Okay. So now let's mention the relation to other models. Levine and Speziale proposed to use SU2 coherent states in order to solve the simplicity constraints. Basically, the idea is that they use the SU2 coherent states to construct SO4 coherent states. Just taking the tensor product of SU2 coherent states, and then we impose the simplicity constraints by imposing them on the labels of the coherent states. That's essentially the idea, because the coherent states are labeled by phase-based points. Well, in this case, it's actually sort of discretized phase-based points, but that suffices. I'm not going into detail about this other approach to solving the simplicity constraints, but we can make a little table, as I've done on slide 21 here. The rows correspond to the different ways of solving the simplicity constraints, and then the columns correspond to the different gamma limits. And so on the left-hand side, we have the loop quantum gravity vertex that I presented here, and in the right column, when we use this Casimir operator method, which I've presented above, we get the Barrett-Crane model. But then when we use coherent states, we get this new model, which I'm calling the FKLS model.
So for gamma, For gamma, much less than 1.
Yes.
The two models are the same?
That's right. That's the remarkable thing, yes.
Okay.
It was quite a surprise when Terra told us that. He sent us an email saying, oh, look, I've reproduced your model using coherent states.
Sorry, I have a question, Jonathan.
Yes.
So I think, I mean, it's a very smart way of presenting the result, but I think it's quite confusing for a non-specialist. So
okay.
Let's try to clarify, because so far, I mean, you have talked only about a model which has no immediate parameter. And let's talk first about this type of model.
Yes.
So in that case, there are two theories. One is gravity, and the other one is a topological theory.
Is it? I don't even see that as being the case in the classical theory. I mean, it seems that you have two different gamma sectors, two different barometers.
No, let's forget about gamma first, to simply...
Okay, you wanted to talk about gamma.
In your work, you don't discuss about gamma, and then we introduce gamma in the spin-form quantization. But to clarify, let's try first to ignore gamma. You agree that when you ignore gamma, there are two theories?
That's right, I agree. When you ignore, when you don't have this gamma term, you have the topological sector and the gravitational sector.
There's
yep.
one which is topological and one which is gravitational. The
yes.
quantization you have just shown to us
corresponds, yes.
where you have G plus equal G minus, corresponds to the topological sector.
Yes.
We agree with that. Okay. So that's why it's confusing to call it the LQG vertex, because, you know, this particular model is very interesting but corresponds to the topological sector of
what?
Spin-form quantization. Okay.
Maybe I agreed to something that I didn't mean to agree to.
Let me start over. There are two theories, right? One is topological, the other is gravitational. Gamma.
Yes, that's
there.
Right.
Okay.
Stop. So what is the topological theory and what is the gravitational theory?
So the theory, what I'm saying is that the theory is just present. So there's one topological theory, which is E wedge G wedge F, okay, in the continuum. And the gravitational sector, which is the star E wedge G wedge F.
Okay.
Okay. And the first one, you can show it as 0 degrees of freedom in the continuum. It's a topological theory.
Okay.
Okay. So that's the two sectors. So at the quantum level, you know, one thing which is nice and new in this model is that for the first time, we have a spin-form quantization of these two sectors. And then I can come up to the immediate parameter. But the quantization that Jonathan just described is the quantization of the topological sector.
Well, you claim that.
But
yeah, I agree it's a danger.
The quantization is E wedge G wedge F. So you want to call it somewhere else, but that's, we agree on that. So,
to me, this is the most confusing point. So does Jonathan, Carlo, and everybody agree that what they have done is corresponds to quantization of E wedge F?
No, we don't.
We don't agree with that. I would personally say it's not clear.
I think you even said it in your slide somewhere. That
yes, I do. The next slide, I think.
Sir, you asked.
I'm saying that it's I can see it as a danger. But this model also has many other good points to it, and so I think we're loath.
Okay, I'm not saying that it has not good points, and we can go to some good points. But in order not to confuse the audience and not to have an argument going on for years about a point which has been solved, I want these things to be clarified since the beginning. When there's no gamma, there's two theories, and
sure.
These two sectors, as far as I know, have been, you know, clearly identified. One is gravitational, one is topological, and we should agree on that.
This is Carlo. Can I make a comment?
Yes.
Yeah.
I think I disagree with what Laurent is saying. Namely, there are a lot of things which are not clear about all these models, and there are some arguments that point in some directions and some arguments that point in opposite directions. In this context, to say this model is topological, I think is wrong, unless one has proof that this model is topological. And
I'm not saying that the model is topological. I'm saying that the discrete action you're writing down, and I think, Carlo, there's absolutely no confusion with that. It's clearly stated. There's even an independent argument by Barrett and Baez, which came up to the same conclusion from completely different...
Well, maybe I don't see either. I don't see any of these arguments. And I also think that these arguments are a little bit empty because we've been discussing dozens of spin-form models which on the basis of a priori arguments like these. I think what is interesting is that there are these models, and one can study what are the physics that they give. Now, if the classical limit of this thing we call the loop quantum gravity vertex turns out to be the topological sector, then that's a possibility. We don't have a proof that this is not the case, but all the indications that we have from the way we look at that are contraries. I don't want to context the opposite indication.
So did you read the other works on that? I mean, I would say the other way around. It's great that we have a topological sector model because if we
Laurent, you may have an opinion and it's very well, but you cannot ask everybody to agree with your opinion,
the
right?
The thing that we have is that there is two models. One of the two is topological, and I think the arguments are pretty
we disagree.
One is which, but it's great that there is one topological model.
No, thank you, but we disagree.
Let me finish.
Thank you for telling us we are great, but we disagree.
Why is it great? It's great because if we don't find that this this model, you know, gets topological, it means that we don't master the spin form quantization. So we have really a nice. So there's one of the two models which is trivial in the continuum limit, and then mastering spin form quantization.
It's far from obvious.
What?
Who says so?
That there's two sectors. There's two sectors classically.
This is a very indirect argument. I mean, this is
it's not very indirect. I mean, what you can compute is the expectation.
Okay, so this is your opinion, but you ask if we all agree, and the answer is no. We disagree.
Do you agree that there's?
Find this a vague argument, not a convincing argument.
Do you agree that there are two models? There are two.
There are three models on the table right now.
What do you mean three?
There is look at the transparency in front of you. There are three models there. There's, one is called the LQ vertex. One is called the Friedel-Krasnov-Levine-Speciale model, and one is called the Barry-Crane model.
If you impose the constraint, so the model we propose, you can show it's a way. If you impose the constraint weakly, there's two models. We agree on that.
Laurent, we're very happy that you have a model, and we're very happy that you believe in it very much. But fine.
It's not that I want
three models, and they're on the table, not two.
What?
There are three models.
In fact,
there are four, because there is also the
I think Alfie needs more clarity than confusion, and the great thing about your work is that now we came to a phase where things are way more clear than before. For instance,
let me give you Jonathan back again.
What?
So can I would like, no, Carlo, please stay there.
I would like to be
an outsider, naive person, and just ask questions. And let us not make statements about what is great about one model, what is not great about one model, but just make statements about what we know to be technically true and what we don't know yet to be technically true, okay? So at the zeroth level, just look at the classical theory. It is true that there are two actions that we can write down a priori, namely E wedge E wedge F and star E wedge E wedge F. The second of them just corresponds to classical relativity, and the first of them is a different model which we can call topological classically, or we can call something else. Let's just call it non-classical relativity model. Okay, so there are two models. I think everybody agrees with that, Carlo and Laurent?
Yes.
Okay. Now we're going to quantization. And it seems to me that, first of all, what is discretizing and
can I say just one thing? There are two models, and there is the theory given by the linear combination of them.
Yes. And so
there is in fact a one-parameter family of models, which is very different than two models.
So there is Emir Zipamera, but let's put Emir Zipamera for zero to not complicate, and we can put Emir Zipamera back into the game.
But we don't.
Well, you did. I mean, the model presented here is at zero Emir Zipamera. We included the Emir Zipamera. I agree in both cases, but that's another story.
Can you go ahead?
Yeah. So classically, there's a one-parameter family of models, as Carlo says. But really, when Jonathan says something is much less than one and something is much bigger than one, I mean, what is really kept is a leading order term. And therefore, it really corresponds to either putting emergency parameter equal to zero or infinity. Do you agree or not, Carlo? Maybe I'm missing something here.
Well, not at all. I mean, we have no idea if we take the continuum, if you take the limit, if this limit is continuous or not. I mean, this is a big jump to say that the limit of this for gamma is small.
But classically, isn't it true that the limit exists?
Yeah.
No, it's not. even classical is not continuous. I mean, in fact, it's not continuous classically. That's exactly the point. I mean, if you can take gamma arbitrary small, and you have a theory which is infinitely different from gamma zero.
Okay. So that's very good. Very good. Carlos, so you're saying that, well, what we can do is we can classically, really, maybe that's what I meant by saying that there are four models. Namely, we can just consider the model with gamma equal to zero, or we can take the model which is the limit gamma equal to zero.
Yes.
And you are saying that these two models, even classically, would disagree with each other.
Oh, infinitely, because one is GR, the other has no degrees of freedom.
Yeah. And the other, and similarly, there is gamma equal to infinity, and taking the limit gamma equal to infinity. So there are these four possibilities.
Yes.
Okay. Then we go to quantum theory, okay?
Yes.
Now, if in the quantum theory, one really had a theory which corresponds to finite gamma, and then took the limit of this theory, I would understand. But from Jonathan's presentation, it was not clear to me that one has really identified the theory for finite gamma.
In fact, we don't have a theory for finite gamma. Somehow we
there is one. I'm sorry. There is one for finite gamma. I mean, there is a spin form model for finite gamma in both sectors.
Okay.
You can, I mean, if you use the coherent space, you can write the theory for finite gamma, both in...
Yes, I know, I read this part in your paper. It was, you mentioned there that gamma has to be rational and has to be greater than 1 and things like this. But I'm also a little bit disturbed by this, because we know from the entropy calculation that gamma is, well, it's smaller than 1 and it's transcendental. So,
So what I can say is that here, first, we are not in the Lorentzian case. In the Lorentzian case, there will not be restriction. So the thing is that, as you mentioned, gamma bigger than 1 and gamma smaller than 1. So, you know, in the gravitational sector, you can have gamma bigger than 1, and in the topological sector, you can have gamma smaller than 1. But as you just said, gamma smaller than 1 in the topological, sector. Sorry, in both sectors you have gamma bigger than 1, but gamma bigger than 1 in the topological sector is like gamma smaller than 1 in the gravitational sector. So first you have the whole range of gamma accessible.
I see.
And then the result is that it's true, that if you want to do Euclidean spinform quantization, you can include gamma only if it is a rational number. And that's the result of the quantization procedure. It's not consistent otherwise.
Okay. I wanted to say one thing before the time runs out. It was, so about the name for the loop quantum gravity vertex, I actually think it's appropriate because of the motivation. One thing we were really motivated by is we wanted to have this match with the loop quantum gravity Hilbert space, and this is our motivation, and this is what we have. And actually, this is one of the weaknesses of the other of your model, is it's not clear at all that your boundary Hilbert space has any direct relation to loop quantum gravity.
Let me agree and disagree. I would agree with you that in both models, the correspondence with loop quantum gravity, you know, is not fully understood, at least for me, and needs really to be worked out at a much more satisfactory.
It's only kinematically understood.
But that's going to be a very important part of, you know, a piece of work in the future. Now, in both models, you know, you can look at the boundary spin networks, and they're both labeled by SO3 spin networks. So in both cases, you know, the boundary Hilbert space is the same as LQG. And that's a great feature of your model. So, and that's a great thing, because now we can study the relationship and understand, you know, better in which way this is an Hamiltonian evolution equation and so on and so forth. But I would disagree with the second statement that both cases, you look at the boundary, but, you know, the boundary states, and they are SO3 spin networks, independently of the model. The dynamics doesn't, you know, change that much.
Okay.
And also in the case where you have non-zero inertia parameter, What changed is the relationship between the internal SO4 spin and the label of the intertwiner. But that's something different. And this map depends on gamma, whether it's smaller than 1, bigger than 1.
Okay, but again, we have a bridge until our time. That is another 20 minutes or so.
Oh, wow. Okay.
So let me just sort of go back and just from an outside point of view, because most of us will not understand the technical subtleties here. So at least some global picture of where we are. So Jonathan and Carlo, I want to summarize what you are saying, and just let's all understand whether this is correct or not. I mean, whether this understanding is correct or not. Namely, that you at the classical level already, there are kind of several possibilities. One is to set the emergency parameter equal to 0 or infinity, and the other is to take limit from finite value.
Yes.
And this is, and the two things are in equivalent to each other. So from that sense, even if we looked at these limiting values, there really are four theories.
Yes.
Maybe we don't understand the...
Can I have a precision? It's just about the limiting process. That is, let's say you can take the limit where gamma goes to zero at infinity, and you don't touch the value of B. And then that's one way to do it. The other way to do it is that you send gamma to zero to infinity, but you also send B to zero or infinity correspondingly. So that's another limit.
That's why you
get different factors. So it's really in different way of taking the limit.
Why would you send B to zero?
Well, you have to do that. You know, in one of your versions, if you want to interpret the model you wrote as a gamma smaller than one gravity, then you have to rescale B. It was in one of your first slides. So
yes.
When you say you can go to one of your first slides.
When
you have gamma is very small. I don't know which one it was. Not this one after. I don't know the number. I mean, it was on one of your slide that the limit gamma is to zero, if you want it to be corresponding to gravity, should also be something related to B going to infinity or B going to zero.
One should be careful because also in these two sectors, the Newton constant is also changing. In fact, the relation between the two Newton constants involves a factor of gamma, and if one is more careful...
That's what I'm saying. So in the spin foam thing, you know, when you take the limit gamma goes to zero, if you really want, let's say if you start from the topological sector and you would like to recover the gravity from there, then you will have to take the limit gamma goes to zero or gamma goes to infinity, but at the same time you will have to rescale the spin to infinity. And that, you know, if you do that, this operation jointly, then the model you would end up at the end would be some gravity in, you know, a gravity for gamma equal to zero. But if you do the naive limit, that is, if you don't touch the spin, then it's different. So.
Okay.
I mean, I just wanted to precise that. It's not like there are four models. There are different ways of taking the limit gamma goes to zero.
Absolutely. So, the usual problem about taking limits is that we have to specify what we keep constant.
Yes.
And so otherwise we don't know what limit means. Yeah. So we get that there are limiting theories, and then there is a theory with precise values of gamma. And Carlo is saying... And Carlo and Jonathan are saying that, well, there is a quantization, that one goes to discretization and one imposes simplicity constraint and so on, and then one gets some theory. And they're saying that theory is analogous to taking the limit gamma goes to zero or gamma goes to infinity, keeping certain things fixed, of course, which they are not, at least I have not understood exactly what they are, but they have something in mind. And I think... they're saying that the physics of this is not yet completely understood. And we're to explore it, and we're to find out what it really is.
Well, it seems to me that...
Is that a reasonably correct summary, Carlo and Jonathan?
Yes.
Okay. Now...
Well, it seems to me that you're not taking... I mean, the model you're describing here is not obtained by taking a limit. It's the model just starting from the action where there's no emergency parameter. That's my first point.
Well, you can also think of it as very small gamma.
But we say it's different. So we say, thinking of gamma very small, depending if you reskill G or not, it is different. So it's, you know, it corresponds to the model where there's no gamma in the action. So, maybe, so that there's no confusion about taking the limit there.
So maybe this is a technical point of disagreement. So it seems to me that Laura is saying that the way, if I look at the quantum theory, that quantum theory could have been obtained not as a limit, but setting gamma equal to a specific value. And Carlo and Jonathan are saying, no, it really does correspond to taking a limit. Is this, we just want to know what we disagree. Is this a point of disagreement?
I mean, I think I agree with that.
Okay, so that's a point. So we agree on what we disagree. That's good. Okay.
I'm sure we disagree on that, Stephen, that your model is... You claim your model is the limit. I'm confused by what you're claiming there.
Right. So their claim is that the model should be really thought of correctly. Thought of. I mean, the intuition behind that model or whatever is really that you should be thought of as a limit.
That's not what's in their paper. So I'm confused.
This is Carlo again. I'm not sure this is the correct way of approaching things. I mean, if you go into the detail, there are a lot of technical details we could discuss one by one. Where is the limit taken? Where is gamma? Where we put it small, which is large? I think what is interesting is that you start from the whole action, you take gamma small, and you get to a certain quantum theory through a number of steps, which are all arbitrary. Whether you do one way or the other way, or the Barrett-Crane model of the Levine Speciale, or the you take coherent states, you take you write the constraint in a certain way, you order in a certain way. It's remarkable, seems to me quite remarkable, that after 10 years of the Barrett-Crane model, in which a number of indication piled up that is not going to give the dynamics of general relativity, now we have two new definition of vertices which have features, interesting features. I don't think we're going to separate between the two by pretending that there is a rigorous quantization procedure from classical general relativity to a spinform model and which one of the two implements it correctly. I don't think this is the case. I think these two define some quantum theories. It may very well that one of the two is trivial. It's possible. It may very well that one of the two has nothing to do with gravity. It's possible. I mean, let's hope that one of the two has to do with gravity and has general relativity in the classical limit. I think that's the only reasonable attitude. We call it, as Jonathan was saying, we call it loop quantum gravity because we like a number of features of it. It matches well with canonical theory. For instance, the spins are really eigenvalues of the areas. The boundary states, which are eigenstate of the area, are such both from the canonical point of view and from the covariant point of view, which is one of the things we wanted. J is fixed and has the matching value, which agrees in the large J limit. This is not true on the other side. Now, Laurent says, well, yes, but I have a way of looking at the quantization such that I have reason to believe this is this is going to be a trivial theory. That's one thing we worried about. In fact, one of the things we tried to do is to prove that the vertex is topological and it doesn't give degrees of freedom. We failed to prove that, which doesn't mean that the thing's false. In fact, we were long uncertain how to write the paper exactly about that. It's possible. But first of all, we convinced ourselves that this is not a topological theory. The vertex is not topological, which something which is either it is or it is not. It has to do with general relativity, and we have reason to believe, because of the form of the action, that in fact it gives the right the full general relativistic. Now, it seems to me that what is interesting is to ask what is the physics in these two vertices, rather than sort of Friedel's saying, your theory is topological, or us saying, your theory doesn't match with loop quantum gravity. That's not the point to me.
Yeah, so I think I agree with you, Carlo, completely, and I think I mean, but also these statements are both made by both sides in order to understand the, each other's model better. But it is much better if, in fact, the persons, people, the groups which are actually proposing a particular model come up with the physics of that particular model. And there may be viewpoints which are different and intuition may be different, and that may be actually realized in a non-trivial way, and we should just wait and see. So I think we understand now, most of us at least, the viewpoint that Jonathan and Carlo and others have about that specific model. Now, I would like to understand better the viewpoint that that Laura and Kirill have about their model. So each side talking about their own model is what I would like to understand better.
So, I have a question about that. Can I ask a question about that?
Yeah.
One of the things we tried to do here in Marseille, and one of the questions we asked, is whether, I mean, this model is defined in terms of coherent state. Somehow the coherent state enters very much in the definition. So one of the first thing we tried to do is to rewrite it entirely without using coherent states. And we couldn't. So the question is that, are the coherent states sort of necessary for the definition of the model for writing this peculiar vertex apenton? Is there something, and if so, why? I mean, it's my, somehow for me, coherent states are something which are useful to look at the semi-classical states of the theory, to look at the theory from some specific aspects. Why are they necessary for defining the theory at the fundamental level? And if they're not, is there another definition of the model, so another natural way of deriving the model without the need of going through the coherent states?
So, Carlo, this is Simone. I think I can reply.
Oh, hi, Simone.
To this question, and then maybe Laurent can go on. But the quick answer to your question is that no, they're not necessary, and you can, for both sectors, rewrite the full model just getting rid completely of the coherent states. And in the one sector, you get something that is supposed to be your model, and in the other sector, you get something that it's supposed to be closer to the Barrett-Crane model. So you can certainly get rid of these. The reason why we introduced them from the first place was that because we thought those were variables in which the study of the semi-classical limit could have been easier. But certainly you can do the rewriting entirely without them.
And also the third model, you say. You just mentioned two.
So I mentioned the two sectors. I'm looking at non-emergency parameters, so I'm thinking of the two sectors in which, so from the point of view of the coherent states, the two sectors are characterized by taking the self-dual and anti-self-dual parts to be equal, whereas the other model is characterized by taking the self-dual part and anti-self-dual part to be conjugated. So the first choice is the one that leads to the same intertwiner space that you have proposed, whereas the other choice is the one that Laurent is suggesting is what he calls the gravitational one, which is basically, if I can just clarify this point, if you think about the spin networks that gives your coefficients f, I plus, I minus, and I, that defines your model entirely without coherent states, just in terms of that spin network, then the other sector, the one that Laurent is pushing for, can be written in terms of a spin network that looks exactly the same, except that the labels might be different. But once again, you can write it in terms of no coherent states by just changing those coefficients there.
And can you map the boundary SO3 state space into the boundary state of this model in the...
Yes, there's a map. I mean, we wrote...
And does this map... But this map changes the eigenvalues of the area. I mean, it changes the spins, right? It's not a map of the intertwiner spaces.
Well, the intertwiner is different, but the
spin... No, right. But the question is about...
The spin to the spins. It's more complicated.
I mean, if I take a state in the canonical theory, I say the spin network, on which on a given link there is a certain J.
Yes. I mean, it's more complicated. The study with canonical theories for both models, I mean, needs to be improved. I would say to understand really what the mapping. But I mean, we wrote down the model in terms of a 15J symbol, so you can do that. We even wrote this model
Right, but what I don't understand, I mean, we have a map which is at level of intertwiners. I mean, given the intertwiner space of SO3, of loop quantum gravity.
Yeah, there's also kind of an averaging map. So you have a map, you know, here you wrote these things as an averaging map from SO4 to it. It's the same thing. There's a group integral, which is an averaging map. Instead of averaging over the three sphere in the Lorentzian case, you average over the hyperbola. I mean, it's becoming technical, but it's kind of a dual model. It has the same very natural structure. But the whole understanding is, in some sense, it's very much related to the structure that Etera and Alessandrov proposed with this projecting spin network now, kind of related. But the detailed relationship, I mean, somebody should work out in both cases.
Okay.
I'm sorry, should we let Jonathan get to his last slide?
To go back to the questions of Abai, I think, okay, one thing is that if you go to no emergency parameter, you know, there's clearly two theory, and that's why we maybe fight, because it's important to recognize which is which. But more interestingly is that if you go now to the case where there is an emergency parameter, and I stress that this is important that we have now a spin for models with for emergency parameter, then these two sectors, as was remarked by Jonathan, are blended. That is, you know, the one that I call the gravity.
Ron, from this point of view, where is the Barrett-Crane model? What does it represent?
The Barrett-Crane model, it's neither of these. That is, you can look at the sector where there's no emergency parameter, and then we have an intertwiner there. And this intertwiner is picked around the representation zero. So this intertwiner is very much, it's for very large spin in a certain limit.
So it's neither one nor the other, is that right? It's neither one sector nor the other sector.
No, it's neither one. It's just that the Barrett-Crane imposes the constraint. What we show is that you can ask why Barrett-Crane showed that there was no way to find the topological sector in their way of imposing the constraint. They wrote this paper. So when you impose the constraint strongly, you cannot find this other sector. And then you cannot find even the emergency parameter. And that's why we got stuck for a long time, because it was impossible, having this way of looking at things, to impose the you know, to find the emergency parameter. So I think the Barrett-Crane model, in some sense, you know, is great because it captures something right, but it's over. And its study will be relevant for certain subsector of this, you know, physical one. But you know, as far as I, you know, I'm concerned, the Barrett-Crane model is over.
If you want, you can put it in terms that the use of coherent state somehow spreads the imposition of the constraints, and then you can either spread around the Barrett-Crane model, or you can spread somehow around your vertex in some sense. So the box you have in page 21, the second line, you can obtain the two sectors, gamma much smaller than 1 and gamma much bigger than 1.
This is Roberto Pereira. You said that when you use the coherent states to impose, so in the sector where you get the loop quantum gravity vertex, actually when you use the coherent state to get exactly the same model, there's no spread. And
yes,
but when you get the spread on the Barrett-Crane on the other sector.
In fact, your model imposes the constraints weakly as well.
Exactly the same way.
Sorry.
When you impose the constraint weakly. Yeah.
Thanks for pointing that out. Yes, absolutely. So, if you want, once you look at the other sector, it's like you're looking at imposing weakly the constraints, but once again around an intertwiner that looks like the Barrett-Crane trivial intertwiner.
So, remark I wanted to make is about this emergency parameter. So we fight about these two sectors, but when you let the emergency parameter being non-zero, then these two sectors become either gamma is bigger than 1 or gamma is smaller than 1. And it turns out that in spin-form quantization, you have two results. First, that gamma is discrete, a rational number in a Euclidean regime, and also the fact that the gamma bigger than 1 sector is very different in quantization to the gamma smaller than 1. So gamma smaller than 1 is more like the model of Carlo et al., and gamma bigger than 1 is more like the model we proposed. So you know, with different gamma, in some sense, I agree then with the statement of Carlo that if you work with different gammas, then both sectors are different. The interpretations of the area is a bit different because the spin should be rescaled by gamma, etc. But apart from that, so if you let gamma different from zero, then both sectors, if you want, you know, should be physical. Now, and then for some reason, which is mysterious, but that's what happens, having gamma smaller than one or bigger than one leads to really different, a priori different way of quantizing the theory.
Shall we let Jonathan get to his last slide?
Okay.
Yeah, sure. It's well, I mean, it's just a conclusion slide. I don't think there's anything new to say.
Well, for instance, it says there that the new intertwiner degrees of freedom may solve the problem of a gravitation propagator.
Yes, that's true. Yeah, there are people who are working on that. I'm just, we've already talked about all of these conclusion points in the discussion. I mean, even I have on the slide here that I'm admitting that it's possible that this is a topological sector, but I'm being a little bit agnostic about it here.
Yeah, maybe to answer Jorge's question about the graviton propagator, just to point out that so far in the graviton propagator, we have been looking at basically area correlations, namely the graviton propagator of the form H mu mu, H nu nu, where only the spin labels of the boundary spin network would enter the calculation. And so for those labels, the Barclay model is fine as a transition amplitude, and so that could be done. Whereas if you now look at graviton propagator where all the four indices are different, that corresponds more like angle correlations from the point of view of the discrete geometry, and those angle variables are described in terms of intertwiners. So if there's no degrees of freedom for the intertwiners in the vertex, in the dynamical vertex, you cannot really compute correlation between those.
Yes.
That's how that could be improved.
Yes.
Okay, thanks.
So I guess I can go to the very last slide, which just has to do with the more tasks and questions. So that's slide 23. So actually, Friedel and Krasnov have found a GFT formulation of both this loop quantum gravity model and their model. And one can also ask other questions. Friedel and Krasnov have some proposals for finite non-negligible gamma. Maybe one can look into that more carefully. Maybe they're right. I don't know. One can also look at more than four valent nodes. Most people don't talk about that, but in loop quantum gravity, actually the restriction to four valent nodes is rather artificial, and it comes from the fact that you're using a simplicial decomposition. It would be more complicated to use a more general decomposition, but it's one thing one could look at. And a Lorentzian formulation of the present model, Friedel and Krasnov in their paper, they give some general prescription for a Lorentzian formulation of their model. I think it's somewhat formal, that they have some regularization to do before it's well-defined. And we need to see if we can prove some sort of finiteness results for these new models, and then we also need to investigate the graviton propagator. So, and hopefully looking at these questions will help us better understand these new alternatives to the Barrett-Crane model. So I guess I'll stop there.
Okay, as an outsider, I really feel this is wonderful because, I mean, we have been very confused with this paper, looking at the papers, and I think this discussion has clarified lots and lots of issues. So thanks very much, Carlo and Jonathan and Laura, and I guess Kirill, if he's not there, and also Simone.
Sure. Was a pleasure.
Okay, so... Hey, what is happening 2 weeks from now?